Hi, this is Jacob Heilbrun, the editor of The National Interest. Welcome to another episode of In the National Interest, this time with Professor Ionut Popescu, who is a professor of political science at Texas State University. And today happens to be the first day in which his new book, No Peer Rivals, is available. Ionut comes to us thanks to our good friend Dan Negrea, formerly of the Atlantic Council, and he's written a number of pieces for the website, both on his own and with Dan. Ionut, I wanted to ask you first, why did you write your new book? What animated you?
Hello, Jacob, and it's great to be here. I love the podcast and really appreciate that chance to share my new book with your listeners. This book is, as the title suggests, No Peer Rivals, a book on grand strategy in the era of great power competition. And it has a very focused theoretical framework on offensive realism. And the reason why I wrote it was because I felt that a lot of the debate on grand strategy is between a restrained realist school and the more liberal, hegemonic, dominant establishment narrative. And my perspective is neither one of those two. I would argue that my realist perspective, my version of realism, is actually closer to both what the Trump administration is trying to do and also with what is the best grand strategy for the United States, given how Russia and China have been acting in the past decade.
So tell us, what is your thesis?
My thesis is that for the United States to maintain its current position as the global superpower, and more importantly, as the country that is the only great power that's a regional hegemon, that is, that dominates its own region, in our case, the Western Hemisphere, we need to focus on containing the ambitions of China to become regional and then global hegemon, but we need to do it in a way that is actually cost effective and in a way that it does not imply that we need to continue a global hegemonic grand strategy. In other words, we need to prioritize the rise of China over providing stability to the Middle East or defending Europe or fighting transnational challenges like terrorism or climate change in a way that is wasting, or if you will, in the way that is using up all the resources that we need to save for the Asia-Pacific theater. So it's a thesis of prioritization.
So containment implies that you are not interested in rollback, which was one of the big controversies during the Cold War. So you want to stymie China, but not to overthrow the regime. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct. And being a structural realist theory that's grounding the narrative of the book, I do not want to focus on the internal politics of either China or Russia or Iran. So this is not a grand strategy that's focusing on regime change or on the promotion of democracy necessarily, but rather it's focusing on the balance of power. And the current balance of power, I believe, is favoring the United States, and we should want to keep it that way.
Now, would that include maintaining alliances with Japan and South Korea?
Absolutely. And not just with them, but also building up the anti-hegemonic coalition in Asia, like Rich Colby calls it, adding India, adding Australia, Thailand, Vietnam, Philippines. And since you mentioned alliances, I believe that that is the most important alliance strategy for the United States right now. So the emphasis should shift from NATO towards our coalition partners in Asia that will be key to prevent China from establishing regional hegemony in that region.
Now, I want to ask you how this new book mates with your earlier one, which was called Emergent Strategy and Grand Strategy, How American Presidents Succeed in Foreign Policy. And there you suggested that leaders should prioritize learning from the mistakes they often make early in their careers and adapt their plans to unanticipated events, and that policymakers should be skeptical of the notion that implementing a long-term grand strategy is, in fact, the best road to a successful foreign policy legacy. Have you changed your mind in advocating a grand strategy approach toward China?
That's a very good question. And in my first book, as you indicated, I highlighted some of the instances in which an emergent approach is better than a long-term grand strategic approach. And one of the key factors in that is the confidence that one can have in the main challenge for a nation's grand strategy over a longer period of time. So when predictions are very hard or unreliable, an emergent strategy makes perfect sense. Now, I happen to believe that in our current grand strategic era, predicting the main challenges for the next 10 or 20 years is not quite as difficult. At least in my view, it's clear to me that China is, and the rise of China and their ambitions is the main strategic competitor. And therefore, we can design a grand strategy focused on the containment of China, while of course maintaining flexibility in how we do it. But I see this in many ways as a period similar to the early Cold War period, where the United States, through both emergent and grand strategic planning, arrived at more or less a consensus containment strategy. Unlike, let's say, the 1990s, where it was very unclear what would be the main security challenge, and unlike the post 9/11 era, where we had this threat of terrorism that seemed to provide that organizing principle, and we can discuss whether that was the correct focus or not. I would argue that it was not. We should have started focusing on great powers like China earlier. But be that as it may, at this point, I think that the current great power competition framework for describing the world is solid enough to build a grand strategy around that.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you thought that the Trump administration was, in fact, pursuing the kind of policy that you recommended toward China, which included emphasizing Asia above the Middle East and Europe. But the Trump administration seems to be coming entangled in the Middle East again, at least if our bombing of Yemen is any indication. What's your take on that development?
Yes, you're exactly right. They're pursuing the right things Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then Tuesday, Thursdays, they're ending up back to the Middle East, back to Eastern Europe. It is, I think, partly a function of the fact that the Trump administration, even though less than in the first term, it still has a variety of views. The people staffing the administration, there are still people who are, through professional or intellectual biases, are still very much in favor of, say, bombing the Houthis, countering Iran, helping Ukraine and NATO countries deal with the threat of Russia. So the biggest challenge for the Trump administration will be to separate between the first order threats, which I think in their speeches and in their documents, they have them right as China and to a more domestic-oriented part, the Western Hemisphere, the border, Mexico, cartels, all of that, which are also the two things I outline in my book, because as a regional hegemon that I argue the United States is in the current position, you should first secure your own hemisphere and then make sure no other country dominates theirs. So China and Western Hemisphere, theoretically, are the right priorities. The problem, of course, in practice is that the second order threats, you know, the Russias and the Middle East and other second order threats are sometimes taking over the headlines, and they can have a way. Iran was the other one I was thinking. They can have a way of getting in the way of the first order threats. So the way I would judge the administration's performance going forward is to what extent they can actually stick to what I think the president and most of his top advisors kind of understand to be the main priorities.
How likely do you think it is that the current effort in the Middle East will expand to attacking Iran itself? Trump has indicated that he wants a resolution on the issue of Iran within the next 2 months. What's your analysis?
I don't think that it's very likely we will attack Iran. I think it's slightly more likely, but still probably no more than 50-50 chance, if that, that Israel will attack, whether through direct or cyber or covert enhanced way with special forces, or basically sabotaging their nuclear program the way that they've been trying to. But I do not see a war starting in the next 2 months. I certainly hope and advocate for not doing that and giving a diplomatic and economic solution a real chance. I think that the administration is trying and hopefully will be able to succeed in putting enough economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran to reach a deal. And President Trump is someone that always focused on deals. I think the Iranians would be well advised to take him seriously on that and not treat this as a chance for them to enhance their reputation. Or I know that there was this tweet from the Iranian side that they didn't read his letter or whatever. I think that's just not productive. And I think they also underestimate the extent to which President Trump really is committed to peace and to not needlessly start a war in the Middle East. After all, his opposition to the Iraq war is something that, to me, he looks most proud of. So I don't think that he's eager to start a conflict. But like I said, like with the Houthis, I didn't necessarily see that as being a very likely occurrence that we would launch a massive campaign against the Houthis. So there could be parts of the administration that may convince the president to do something like that. But I think that would be stupid and unproductive, and hopefully he will not do that.
Now, your term, no peer rival, does that imply that the United States can exercise its power at will, that this is a kind of unipolar moment? Or do you mean that the United States is just ahead or remains ahead of Russia and China?
The second, I think we live in a multipolar world, but this multipolar world only still has one regional hegemon, the United States, and we have the ability to make sure other countries do not become regional hegemons by virtue of not having peer rival competitors in our own hemisphere. The goal for the United States, like I mentioned, should be to continue to not be challenged in its own hemisphere by the Chinese and the Russians, and to prevent the Chinese Communist Party, which is the only entity with the will and the ability to control its own region, from doing that. So that's why I think one of the greatest grand strategic priorities for the United States, and this may be a little controversial, should be to make sure that our main two opponents, Russia and China, are not going to end up in an alliance as they seem to. I advocate for, along with other people who have suggested this, really trying hard to sell the war in Ukraine so that we can develop a relationship with Russia that would allow us, if not to be allies, at the very least to get Russia to be neutral in the contest against China. Because realistically, and from a realist perspective, that step would make a lot of sense given the Russian-Chinese competing interests in along their own border, and given how energy markets work. If we can get past the Ukraine situation and the whole ideological conflict with Putin and a large part of the US establishment, that would be the move in this kind of configuration of power for us to do.
So you don't see Putin as a revanchist leader whose first mission is to absorb Ukraine and then to go on to reconstitute as much of the original Soviet Union as possible?
I see him and Russia in general, even if it's not Putin, a lot of the alternatives are very similar in that particular decision and strategic framework. I see them as a country that is trying to reestablish their sphere of influence in what they call the near abroad. It's basically the former Soviet Union, so the Russia, the Moldovas, the Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia. But I don't think that past that near abroad sphere of influence, he is going to try to go into like Romania, where I grew up, or Estonia or Latvia. So I think that there is a balance of power in Europe that is workable and acceptable to both us and the Russians. And the fault line there is Ukraine. If we could get Ukraine settled one way or another, I do not think that Russia will go on to the next NATO country or anything like that.
Well, Professor Popescu, this was a fascinating conversation, particularly apt because we focused on realism, which is, of course, of central interest to readers of the National Interest. And I hope we can do this again soon.
Thank you so much. It's great talking to you.
Thank you.